Hello, and welcome to Good News Gathering. If you enjoy this lesson, we invite you to check out Good News Gathering at one of our Sunday services. Visit www.goodnewsgathering.org for service times and directions to our ministry center. Now let's join teaching pastor Jeff Lyle as he presents today's lesson.
You know, it's tragic, but stories like Marin's are becoming more and more common every day. Age doesn't matter. Addiction strikes the young and the old alike. Gender doesn't matter. Both men and women struggle with various forms of addictions. Economic level doesn't matter. From the poorest of the poor to the filthy rich, they're bound together by a chain of desperation called addiction. Did you know that in the United States there are approximately 330 million people? 30 million of those people struggle with a chemical addiction. 30 million. But let's bring that a little closer to home. If you think addiction really isn't your concern, get this. According to a 2016 Highland County Community Health Assessment, 70% of the people know someone personally who uses marijuana. 51% know someone personally who uses heroin. And 49% know someone personally who abuses prescription drugs. Now, let's be honest. In a crowd this size, there are people here this morning who are using marijuana, heroin, or abusing prescription drugs. That's just reality. And those that aren't using know somebody who is, at least half of us. Now, I can imagine that there are some of you here this morning that are thinking, well, why is marijuana on that list? I mean, it's no worse than alcohol. I mean, seriously, Jeff, aren't states even legalizing the use? That may be true. That doesn't make it wise. Did you know that nearly all people who use heroin also use at least one other drug, and most use at least three other drugs? In fact, studies indicate that people who are addicted to alcohol are two times more likely to become addicted to heroin. For marijuana, it's three times. For cocaine, it's 15 times. Prescribed opioid painkillers, 40 times more likely to be addicted to heroin. Did you know that 80% of all heroin addicts started with pain medications? In other words, a vast majority have some legitimate pain issues stemming from either an injury or surgery for which they were prescribed legitimately pain medications. But what began as a legitimate need descended into an addiction at some point. Our culture's mistaken belief that our lives should be perfect and pain-free has resulted in the overprescription of painkillers of monumental proportions. Think about this. Did you know that the number of opiates prescribed per person in Ohio is enough to give every Ohio resident 166 pills? This is based on a study that was conducted in 2013. And here's where it gets really scary. Average age of first use of prescription drugs is 14. Now, some of these are legitimate prescriptions, but some are getting them from their parents' or their grandparents' medicine cabinet. In fact, law enforcement tells us that kids are beginning to have what's now known as Skittles parties, where they go through their house and pilfer whatever pills that they can find. They put them all together, jumble them up, and then reach in and grab a handful. Who knows what you're getting? And here's the grim reality. 1 in 5 teens in Ohio will try heroin today. There will be 8 to 10 overdoses today. The risks are huge. Now think about it. When you buy drugs of any kind off the street, there's no way of knowing what you're getting. I mean, it's not like you're dealing with model citizens, right? You can't trust these people. Recently, drug dealers have been lacing their products with things called fentanyl, or the even deadlier carfentanil, which is actually an elephant tranquilizer. And as you can see, fentanyl deaths in Ohio are on the rise. Now, some of you are familiar with this picture. It's made the rounds on the internet. Police in East Liverpool, Ohio, found this mother and her boyfriend, both of whom had OD'd, with their 4-year-old child in the back seat, strapped in a car seat. Now, some of you here this morning are probably thinking, you know what, Jeff, I didn't come to church to hear about drugs. I come to church to hear about Jesus, so why don't we just stick to religion? You might want to rethink how you think. Remember how Jesus was described. He was described as a friend of sinners. Sinners just like you. Sinners just like me. And sinners just like those people seated in the front seat of that car. Some of you here this morning are playing with fire. It may be alcohol. It may be marijuana. It may be prescription drugs or something harder. And you're feeling that pull. But there's something in the back of your mind that keeps telling you, you know what, I can handle this. I can quit anytime I want. You better rethink how you think. Some of you have a friend or a loved one who's dealing with an addiction. And maybe they've bummed money off of you, or maybe they've just flat out stolen from you. And you're at a point where you're saying to yourself, you know what, I'm writing them off because there is no hope. They're hopeless. You might want to rethink how you think. And some of you may be thinking, you know what, Jeff, this doesn't concern me. All right, it's not my problem. I'm not one of those addicts. You better rethink how you think. You see, it is your problem. It's your problem every time you go to the store and you pay a higher price for their products because they have to make up the difference for the amount of stuff that gets stolen to support people's habits. You pay for it. Your taxes pay for it. Because your taxes are now going to create drug courts that only deal with drug cases. Why? Because we can't produce enough tax dollars to build prisons fast enough to hold them all. And what's more, everybody knows that prisons don't cure it. So you're paying for it. It's your problem because this drug epidemic is threatening our already tottering healthcare system. So don't kid yourself. It is your problem. And it's my problem. It's our problem. And we have to rethink how we think. Now, our focus verse for this lesson series is Romans 12:2. It's coming up here on your screens. Let's all recite it together. Here we go. Don't copy the behavior and customs of this world, but let God transform you into a new person by changing the way you think. Now, friends, if this is your first time at Good News Gathering, you got an outline when you came in this morning. And that outline's a white sheet with 3 holes punched on the side. And it'll give you some points in some scriptures and also some fill-in-the-blanks that will help you follow along with this morning's lesson. But as we've been discovering over the past 4 weeks, all of the problems that we see today go right back to the Garden of Eden. And when God created Adam and Eve, he placed them in this perfect environment. And there was only one restriction. You can't eat from this one tree. God said, don't eat from this one tree or you will die. Clear choice. Don't eat or eat. Obey or disobey. Life or death. But the Bible says, when the woman saw the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some of it and ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. Now, God was clear, don't eat, but I think it'll taste good. Don't eat, but it looks really good. Don't eat, well, it'll give me something that I don't currently have. Something I think God is holding back from me. And that's just how addiction begins. God says, don't do that. Well, just try it once. It'll be fun. You can stop anytime you want. It'll help you fit in with the crowd. It'll relieve your pain. Or as one addict told me, you know, when I'm high, I'm invincible. Now, friends, this morning, what I've done is I've invited some people who know a whole lot about this subject to come up and help us to learn about this thing called addiction. And I want to start this morning by talking about addiction and our brain. What goes on in our brain when we become addicted? And I want to introduce you to Melissa Wilson. And Melissa Wilson and JD are both here to help us answer this question. So Melissa, what actually happens in the brain when a person uses drugs?
So Jeff, I am Melissa, and I was hired by the military as a nurse scientist to look into this, the impact of pain treatment on our military members that are injured in service. And so I've been highly involved in this topic for a number of years. And the brain is such a unique organ. It's responsible. It's our control center. It's completely responsible for all behavior, emotions, our movement, memory, our senses. Everything that happens in this very important organ. It's so important that it was placed inside of this tight, deeply guarded chamber that we actually call it the vault, because it's so important that it survives, that it's critical for our survival. Now, there's not going to be a test over the layers of the brain. I'm not going to say that. But what I want you to grasp from this picture is all the layers that we have surrounding our brain. And each layer is got a different responsibility. That's just on the outside, so that we can prevent stuff from going in and penetrating our brain. And we have internal guards that are guarding this vault also. So it's the first organ in our body that gets fuel. Of all the other organs, it's the first one to get fuel, which our body then turns, it's our energy source. So it's the first one to get fuel. It's also the last one to die when our body is leaving. Our brain is so tightly guarded by these protective mechanisms that very few substances can penetrate this tight guard over our brain. This is both good and bad for us. The brain operates normally under chemical reactions. That's how our brain operates. For example, if you need fuel to run, your brain will send a signal to your hunger center, and it will say, hey, you either need to send up some glucose from your muscles, your fat, your liver, or you need to eat to ingest some glucose, because we need more fuel. This is why some of you may have experienced the syndrome called hangry. You know, you get hungry, angry, because your brain is saying, you better get me some food right now, okay? So the brain is the controller of that. So it's the first and last of the control center. And as you'll see in this animation here on the screen, this is how our chemical reactions occur. So when our body is operating in normal function, these are messages that are carried by these chemical impulses, and they're received by special chemical impulses. And this is how your body then responds. So the brain can actually change shape, or it can morph based upon these chemical reactions. And this is why we stimulate the brain with education, experiences, those types of things, so that all the brain cells that you were given from birth are used, because it's like a muscle. If you don't use it, you lose it. And so all those cells that we were given at birth They need to be stimulated and they need to be fired to ensure adequate function and shape of our brain. And similar, and guess what else has the ability to mock this chemical reaction? It is a few chemicals that we know as alcohol, nicotine, cocaine, heroin, marijuana, other similar types of substances.
Okay. Now, these substances can actually change both chemical and they can make both chemical and structural changes in your brain. Is that correct?
They can. So very short-term use, what you feel from a drug, that sensation that you feel from the drug is actually a chemical change in your brain that's producing the sensation that you feel. And over time, that change begins to change your brain. And so these changes may take years to reverse. We're going to show some slides of a chemical that is produced naturally in our body. And this is called serotonin. And this is one of those chemicals that keeps us on our equilibrium, keeps us feeling not too high and not too low. And there's a direct relationship between serotonin and depression. If you have low serotonin, then you're likely to experience clinical depression. And you see in this case, we have a person on the left that has not used, in this case it's ecstasy, but you can insert other drugs that change serotonin levels, which is pretty much all of them. So in the left, we have the control of our normal serotonin levels in this cell, and then 2 weeks after the use of ecstasy, we have a significant decrease in serotonin. And then even 7 years after the use, we're not back to that original level. And so research is also indicating that this is what we're seeing. We're seeing more cases of Parkinson's and Alzheimer's in more chronic drug users because of these very factors. We're not ever returning back to our baseline of the chemicals that naturally occur in our brain. And then on this next slide, I'm going to show you a couple of scans of the brain. And on the right, we have a person who's used cocaine. And on the left, we have a person who has not used cocaine. And purple indicates it's bad in this case. And purple indicates the lowest metabolic activity. So more or less, there's no activity going on in the brain. And yellow is vibrant, chemical synapses occurring. And you can see that the brain on the left, or I'm sorry, on the right, has those dark, deep purples that in this state, the acute state here, are very deep and there's not much activity going on in the brain. But the long term, we know that this stays like this for a significant amount of time. And then we have another slide here. It's a different kind of scan. But this is a person who has used methamphetamine. And the yellow-red areas show previously functioning brain, okay? So we are having brain area that is no longer. These areas, it's important to note where this is happening in the brain too. So this is happening in what we call our frontal lobe. This frontal lobe is responsible for a lot of our higher functioning skills. This is what separates us from most other animals. It's that ability to reason. It's that ability to sense what's going on and maybe change your behavior accordingly. It's our reasoning, our perception, our memory, our creativity. And the drugs are damaging that area and altering what we have the ability to do at the moment and long term. And it's also important to note that major growth occurs in this area between the ages of 13 and 26. And I can testify from having teenagers that the frontal lobe isn't working always properly. Until about the age of, like I said, about around 26, it stops. But what's startling about that is most addictions start. 96.5% of addiction starts before the age of 21.
Okay, so addiction causes both chemical and structural changes, which I represented a couple of meth addicts. And the thing that I found so difficult in dealing with them was that they could not seem to connect the dots. You couldn't reason with them. It's like go from A to B to C, and they couldn't do it. And one of them ended up in a psych unit, and to be perfectly honest with you, I don't think that person will ever be right. So not only, we're talking about structural change to the brain and chemical change, but also there are emotional and psychological changes as well. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Talk about that. Why is that?
Well, there's a number of factors in play as it pertains to the psychological and emotional elements of addiction. Because you think about what's actually happening in the addict's brain, right? The individual, you and I, naturally occurring. Melissa just showed a slide a couple of minutes ago of serotonin levels in the brain. Right, and this is a really good photo and a really important one, because what we have to understand is that we have naturally occurring emotional regulating chemicals in our brain, things like serotonin. So serotonin, as you mentioned, is a stabilizing chemical in the brain. In other words, it keeps you at kind of a particular level of mood. Right, when you have enough of it, you're not too high, you're not too low. You just kind of, you do pretty well, and your mood stays pretty stable. You have other chemicals like feel good chemicals or pleasure chemicals, things like dopamine. All right, so when you have really, really great food or really great sex, or you kiss somebody that you really like, or those kinds of things, you're getting these chemical messengers shooting through your brain, going, "Hey, I'm feeling good. Hey, you're feeling good. All right, this is dopamine." All right, when you're, for some of you are people who exercise. All right, so say you go out for a run. A mile or two in, it's going to feel bad. I don't care who you are or how much you exercise, it's going to start feeling bad. And what's going to happen is your brain is going to go, "I need some endorphins." All right, it's going to spit some endorphins into your system. You're going to get this little thing called the runner's high. All right. And what happens with this process is you and I have normal, naturally occurring brain operations that utilize these chemicals, and that's what's happening. Right, that's what's going on, and your body has natural free rein to utilize those chemicals as often as is necessary. What's happening with addiction, and especially over long-term addiction, is that over time, the body shuts down the natural production of things like serotonin, dopamine, endorphins, because what you're in effect saying to your body when you use drugs is, "I don't need you to tell me when to feel good. I'll tell you when I want to feel good. All right, and I'll tell you when I need some dopamine. I'll tell you when I need to relieve some pain." And so what happens is that over time, your body naturally begins to shut down the creation process, the production process, so to speak, of these extremely important chemicals. All right, so serotonin levels dip, dopamine doesn't produce as much, endorphins you don't produce as much, and what happens is that then your body has no way to naturally respond to the normal stresses of everyday life.
Okay. So when, and you know, I've heard people say this, why don't they just stop? I mean, what was the matter with these people? It's bad for them. They know it's bad for them. Why can't they just quit?
Okay, so this is really fun. All right, here's what I want you to do. I'm going to give you guys a thought experiment. We're all going to do this, okay? All right, I want you to put in mind for yourself a problem behavior that you experience. All right. Now, I'm not going to tell you what to pick. It can be super really important or super not important. You can pick chewing your fingernails. Like, that's one of my problems. That's not the problem that I have in mind, though. I can tell you that. All right, so you can pick chewing your fingernails. Maybe you're lazy. Maybe you cuss at people and you don't want to. Or maybe you just get mad a lot of times. Or maybe you spend money too much. It's totally your pick. All right, but what I would ask you to do is, just for the sake of this exercise, if you're thinking of your problem as some kind of drug or alcohol problem, pick something else. Okay, pick some other problem, not drug and alcohol related. All right, and here's what I want you to do. All right, everybody get your problem in your head. All right, I want you to raise your right hand. Just raise it up like this. I'm not going to ask you to tell anything. I'm not going to separate it into categories. Nobody's going to know what you're thinking, okay? I promise. All right, so here's what I want you to do. I want you to lower your right hand when you can answer yes to this question, or to one of the questions I'm going to ask you. Okay, so here's what I want you to do. When you realized that problem was in fact a problem, when you go, oh man, that hurt, or that didn't feel good, or I did that and I shouldn't have, just the moment that you realized that was a problem, all right, I want you to lower your hand right now if immediately at that point you ceased that behavior entirely. Okay. All right. If within a month of recognizing that it was a problem, you quit it entirely, lower your hand. All right. If within 6 months of figuring out that was a problem, you quit it entirely, lower your hand. How about a year? Okay. A couple went down. All right. 3 years. 5 years. All right, keep your hand up if it's still a problem. Look around. Look around. I mean, think of it. You can put your hands down. All right? Here's the simple fact of the matter, guys. You can't just stop it, and neither can I. And we're not, and if you guys did this experiment right, we're not talking about drug and alcohol problems. I heard this fascinating quote from a pastor out of New York named Tim Keller. He once made the statement that not all addiction is sin, but all sin is addiction. At the end of the day, you and I are slaves to stuff. All right, this is who we are. All right, we're slaves to stuff. And, you know, because here's the thing: life is hard, right? We bump up against really difficult circumstances, all right? Some of you may have been traumatized in some way, a rape, an abuse situation. Maybe you grew up in a home where your parents went through a really nasty divorce. Maybe you were bullied in school. I don't know what it is for you, but I can guarantee that if I stopped to talk to each and every one of you, all of you would be able to identify a really negative, traumatizing, difficult emotional situation or psychological situation that you've encountered at some point in life. And here's what happens. Because we're people and because things happen to us, we will all choose some coping strategy or another. We have to be able to deal with life. And so we make decisions about what that's going to be. Some of us use drugs. All right, some of us go exercise. Some of us pray or read our Bible. Some of us, you know, talk to a friend. I mean, all of us have coping strategies, and all of us make decisions about our coping strategies. All right, so you and I, we create these coping strategies for ourselves. Now imagine, just imagine, if that coping strategy that you use on a day-in, day-out basis, that thing that you know is going to work for you, and doggone it, it's going to work every time, I'm going to walk up to you and say, you know what, you need to quit that. You need to not do that anymore because it's not working for you. And I've looked many addicts in the face, and they've looked right back at me, and there've been a few times where somebody, oh, it's working just fine. I feel pretty good. All right. And the simple fact of the matter is, we all make these decisions about how to cope. And so one of the challenges of this experience, this addicted experience, is when you're talking about a person who has been using a drug for a long period of time, what's happening is they are dealing with life by using a substance. If you take that substance away, remember what's happened. The natural, normal, pain-killing, pleasure-giving, stabilizing chemicals in their brain are not at the level of normal production, and they won't be. Melissa's slide has very clearly shown us this. They won't be for some time. So what we're asking, what we're really truly asking addicts to do, all right, when we tell them to quit, is we tell them to give up their number one emotional coping strategy and to deal with the normal stresses, pains, and struggles of everyday life without the natural chemicals that you and I have on, like, on demand to be able to help them deal with it.
Okay. So we're talking about structural and chemical changes. We're talking about emotional and psychological changes. How do we help? And how do these people recover from this? What's the process?
Well, there's a lot of things in play. But first and foremost, you have to go through the detoxification process. I mean, that's just the first thing that if you're going to get off of heroin or off of any drug, really, you have to go through the detoxification process. And typically for heroin or other opioids, it takes about 3 to 5 days. And let me just assure you, having worked with hundreds of addicts over the course of several years, it is the worst 3 to 5 days of their entire life. I once had an addict refer to it as take the very worst flu you've ever had, like diarrhea, vomiting, body chills, fever, awful migraine headaches. Take that if you've ever experienced that, and then do a times 10 by that. And that's the process of getting off of heroin and opioids. Typically, that process cannot kill you. There are some withdrawal syndromes that will kill you, alcohol being one, actually. But typically, heroin and opioid withdrawal will not kill you, but it will. Many of them have said you wish you were dead. Because it's that awful. And it typically takes 3 to 5 days and oftentimes is handled in an inpatient setting because it's just better and easier to have medical professionals around in order to deal with it. The second kind of aspect of the treatment process is typically, for most people, medication-assisted treatment. There are a number of drugs on the market. If you want to know more about it, you can ask me. But we don't have time to deal with those in the specific right now. But the simple fact of the matter is there's a number of drugs on the market that are available to help people withdraw from opioids and then block opioid use moving forward. Typically, in order to see much effect, those individuals have to take those drugs for about 12 to 18 months. It's a normal course of treatment. Concurrent with that is inpatient and outpatient psychotherapy, often done in group formats. Sometimes people pursue it in individual formats, but generally that's anywhere from 6 to 18 months, depending on the severity of the person's challenges and their emotional and historical issues. You know, the more background and baggage you bring to drugs, the more you have to deconstruct on the way out. And then typically there's an aftercare protocol, either through outpatient groups in a community setting or oftentimes addicts are referred to things like AA or NA as a method of community-level support and accountability for dealing with that change in life.
Okay. So Melissa, that third point is that these changes may take years to reverse. There's no guarantee once you start down this road, is there?
Right. Like I said, we're seeing a higher incidence of conditions such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, and so that's impacting, it's going to impact our geriatric and older population, not to mention, you know, what we've known about alcohol for a number of years and cigarette smoking and what it causes and stuff. But it's important to note that what happens in the brain is at the point that a person starts an addictive substance or a substance that changes your chemicals on a regular basis, you're typically stunted at that place. And so remember what I said about the frontal lobe, that higher functioning, that reasoning of, you know, why don't you just quit? Well, because I've stunted the place in my brain that says, oh, that would make sense. This is causing a lot of harmful effects to myself, to my family, to, you know, all the people around me. Well, I've gotten rid of that place in my brain's ability to think through that logically. And so oftentimes you see people, you know, that could be a 40-year-old person that maybe acts like a 15-year-old, or and it's because the drugs have stunted that place in their brain, so they don't have the ability to think through the higher functionings. I gave the example that earlier I was talking about this, and we used to see a lot of times in in the emergency room, people would come in with track marks, you know, all up their arms from in every vein from injecting heroin, and they would say, I would say, oh, okay, you know, we're going to start an IV on you or something. They're like, no, I'm afraid of needles. I'm like, pardon me? What are all these things? But they don't see that as that place in their brain that's reasoning of, okay, I'm going to put in an IV, is not the same to them as injecting the drug that they have to sustain life. Nope, I mean, rarely ever does an addict of heroin or cocaine start out injecting. They start out with a pill. They start out with, I think we said 80% of, you know, people who use heroin started out with pain medicine. They take it in a pill. They smoke it. It's considered the gentler way. And it's also, it's about concentration. It's a lower concentration of it that gets to your brain. But what happens is your brain needs more and more and more of that. It needs in order to function just at a baseline. So then we resort to ways to get it in us that give us a higher concentration.
One of the things that oftentimes in counseling, you'll hear counselors talk about the thought process of an addict. And Melissa made a really important point about the emotional maturity of an individual is often blunted at the point at which they began using drugs. So you may have a chronological 30-year-old who has not gone through the emotional maturing process of dealing with everyday life because they've been using drugs since they were 13. So emotionally, they're not 30, yet chronologically, they're 30. And so how long does it take for you to grow emotionally from being 13 to 30? Well, about 17 years. And when you've been using drugs that entire time, you're not dealing with life. You're checking out. I mean, you're utilizing a coping strategy that doesn't allow you to emotionally mature. You just, okay, I don't want to feel that. I'm not going to feel that. Done. All right, it's this very almost childlike, I want what I want when I want it, and I want it now. You know, like, and that's that kind of, that's the process. And so when you remove maturing and emotionally growing situations from your life, what happens is you stay stuck where you started. And so it often takes years for that person to begin starting to act more adult because they stopped emotionally maturing at an early age because of early onset drug or alcohol use, and they may have physically grown, but they have not emotionally grown.
Okay, so this explains why I have 40-year-old alcoholics that still think it's cool to be big man at the bar on Friday night with all the 20-year-olds.
Exactly.
Yep.
Okay. Now, something you mentioned though, JD, you mentioned that a big part of the recovery process is a group type therapy or involvement in groups like AA or NA, that kind of thing. And I'm thinking to myself that this is perhaps where the church can play a crucial role in providing hope for people, because community is such a huge element. Community. Think about that.
What causes, say, heroin addiction? This is a really stupid question, right? It's obvious. We all know it. Heroin causes heroin addiction. Here's how it works. If you use heroin for 20 days, by day 21, your body would physically crave the drug ferociously because there are chemical hooks in the drug. That's what addiction means. But there's a catch. Almost everything we think we know about addiction is wrong. If you, for example, break your hip, you'll be taken to a hospital and you'll be given loads of diamorphine for weeks or even months. Diamorphine is heroin. It's in fact much stronger heroin than any addict can get on the street because it's not contaminated by all the stuff drug dealers dilute it with. There are people near you being given loads of deluxe heroin in hospitals right now. So at least some of them should become addicts. But this has been closely studied. It doesn't happen. Your grandmother wasn't turned into a junkie by her hip replacement. Why is that? Our current theory of addiction comes in part from a series of experiments that were carried out earlier in the 20th century. The experiment is simple. You take a rat and put it in a cage with two water bottles. One is just water, the other is water laced with heroin or cocaine. Almost every time you run this experiment, the rat will become obsessed with the drugged water and keep coming back for more and more until it kills itself. But in the 1970s, Bruce Alexander, a professor of psychology, noticed something odd about this experiment. The rat is put in the cage all alone. It has nothing to do but take the drugs. What would happen, he wondered, if we tried this differently? So he built Rat Park, which is basically heaven for rats. It's a lush cage where the rats would have colored balls, tunnels to scamper down, plenty of friends to play with, and they could have loads of sex. Everything a rat about town could want. And they would have the drugged water and the normal water bottles. But here's the fascinating thing. In Rat Park, rats hardly ever use the drugged water. None of them ever use it compulsively. None of them ever overdose. But maybe this is a quirk of rats, right? Well, helpfully, there was a human experiment along the same lines, the Vietnam War. 20% of American troops in Vietnam were using a lot of heroin. People back home were really panicked because they thought there would be hundreds of thousands of junkies on the streets of the United States when the war was over. But a study followed the soldiers home and found something striking. They didn't go to rehab. They didn't even go into withdrawal. 95% of them just stopped after they got home. If you believe the old theory of addiction, that makes no sense. But if you believe Professor Alexander's theory, it makes perfect sense. Because if you're put into a horrific jungle in a foreign country where you don't want to be, and you could be forced to kill or die at any moment, doing heroin is a great way to spend your time. But if you go back to your nice home with your friends and your family, it's the equivalent of being taken out of that first cage and put into a human rat park. It's not the chemicals, it's your cage. We need to think about addiction differently. Human beings have an innate need to bond and connect. When we are happy and healthy, we will bond with the people around us. But when we can't, because we're traumatized, isolated, or beaten down by life, we will bond with something that gives us some sense of relief. It might be endlessly checking a smartphone, it might be pornography, video games, Reddit, gambling, or it might be cocaine. But we will bond with something, because that is our human nature. The path out of unhealthy bonds is to form healthy bonds, to be connected to people you want to be present with. Addiction is just one symptom of the crisis of disconnection that's happening all around us. We all feel it. Since the 1950s, the average number of close friends an American has been steadily declining. At the same time, the amount of floor space in their homes has been steadily increasing. To choose floor space over friends, to choose stuff over connection. The war on drugs we've been fighting for almost a century now has made everything worse. Instead of helping people heal and getting their life together, we have cast them out from society. We have made it harder for them to get jobs and become stable. We take benefits and support away from them if we catch them with drugs. We throw them in prison cells, which are literally cages. We put people who are not well in a situation that makes them feel worse and hate them for not recovering. For too long, we've talked only about individual recovery from addiction. But we need now to talk about social recovery, because something has gone wrong with us as a group. We have to build a society that looks a lot more like Rat Park and a lot less like those isolated cages. We are going to have to change the unnatural way we live and rediscover each other. The opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection.
Think about that statement. The opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection. It's connection. And that's where I think the church can become such an important player in this devastating game. Because we can help people find a connection with Jesus Christ and also with a community, a family of people who care for them and love them. You see, there is hope through Christ and through community. That's why the Bible tells us in 1 John, this is the message you heard from the beginning. We should love one another. We know that we have passed from death to life because we love our brothers. Anyone who does not love remains in death. And this is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. Dear children, let's not merely say that we love each other. Let us show the truth by our actions. Notice what it says. It says, love one another, lay down our lives for one another. Why? Because Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. And yet, oftentimes when it comes to this issue, it is not uncommon to hear church people say things like, stop wasting money on those losers. They made their choice. Let them live with the consequences. Some of the more cruel say things like, it's just natural selection at work. Let them die. Now, can you imagine if God took that attitude toward us? What if God said, you know what? They made their choices. And we've all made bad choices. But what if he said, you know what? I'm not sending my son into that mess. Let him die with the consequences. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't like how that feels. So how do we do more than just say we love others? What actions can we take to help others who are struggling with addiction? This morning, I want to introduce you to Kim Davis. Kim is a counselor at Family Recovery Services, and she's going to tell us something about an event that's called Hope Over Heroin that's coming to Highland County next month. Kim?
Hi, thanks for having me. So Hope Over Heroin is an outreach ministry that was started by a group of pastors in around 2014. About that time, heroin had really had its face out there in the community. And in Hamilton County, there was 14 overdoses in one weekend. So these pastors thought, we have got to get more involved in the community. And for them, it was being the hands and feet of Christ. It was getting out and showing that there is hope, hope of a better life, but also hope in for recovery. So what they started throughout Ohio is a two-day event. So I went to my first event about 2 years ago, and I thought, wow, this is incredible. You can feel the Spirit of God. You can feel the love and the energy that this community is kind of paying it forward, giving back. And so I thought, you know, as an alcohol and drug counselor, I thought, this is what we need in our community, you know, to be able to share the love of Christ, but to give a face and hope and that there is a better way to live. So we've kind of collaboratively with all different agencies, you know, about a year ago, getting the ball rolling with the finances and bringing different agencies and just a community together to now within a few weeks actually having this event. It's definitely been God leading this throughout the whole time. There's some things and some doors that have opened that I never thought possible. But I have a lot of people say, you know, how can we become involved? You know, maybe I don't know anybody personally that struggles in addiction, or maybe I don't really know how to address it. It's kind of just something that seems maybe awkward or strange. You know, so I encourage everyone to be involved at a different level. It doesn't mean by going and coming to the event and participating that you have to even have direct contact with others. Maybe it's serving on a committee and maybe just participating through doing registration. You know, maybe it's cooking food. You know, one of the things that this event provides is not just hope and recovery, but we also give out food. You know, this is a great time to hand out hamburgers and water, and but it's also a good time to maybe just put on a face of and smiling to the community. Maybe it's a handshake. Maybe it's a help up. One of the things that we also provide, not besides free, you know, the food and the music, is where it's faith-based, we also do baptisms. You know, so at the end of the event, if someone wants to dedicate their life to Christ, then they're able to get baptized. And from that point on, then we take that person and we'll give them a sponsor, someone that they can connect them with to a church. And that's where the church is really important, not just for the event, but even following up. Because for most of us, we probably remember a time of walking into the church for the first time. You know, and when we walk in with that baggage of sin, it's tough. You know, we feel judged. So what this event, I think, for me, portrays is saying, hey, you know, we care. We're, you know, we might be coming from the church aspect, but we're there with open arms and doors. And so those are just kind of a few things that the church can do to be involved.
Okay. You know, this is a faith-based event, but it also draws in the recovery community as well, and other resources like long-term in-house treatment.
Yes.
Those kind of things are also a part of this whole two-day event, and this is just an awesome thing. Now, just to make sure everybody understands, when people like myself get involved, I mean, I'm not a counselor, but that's not what's expected.
Correct.
Me. And there's a very different ways that we can get involved that's at
Absolutely.
Our comfort levels.
I would say definitely starting with just prayer. You know, we have sign-up sheets for round-the-clock prayers that, you know, we're going to start on the day prior to the event until the event is open. Maybe it's going out to the fairgrounds and just doing a prayer walk. Maybe it's donation. Maybe it's coming out and just doing registration or cooking food or just, you know, being an errand person and getting this and running. And, you know, so it doesn't mean that you necessarily have to counsel someone. We'll have people that will be in the profession and set aside along with pastors to be able to do that.
Okay. Now, friends, there are four ways that we have been asked to help. First is a prayer vigil. And you can sign up in the atrium for that. It's blocks of time, and you can kind of fill in your name. You can do this from home, but we just want to make sure that this event is covered with prayer from the beginning to the very end. We also need help with setup, and the times are there on your outline. But it's just people, and if you got a strong back and you can help lift equipment and that kind of thing, it can really be a big help. A third thing is called a memorial walk. And what we want to do, and this is on Friday at 6 p.m., it just lasts an hour, but if you can come out to the Highland County Fairgrounds and walk, and there will be a course set out there, and it's just a walk to show support for the addressing of this issue. And then finally is security, and I want you to understand this is not crowd control or anything like that. We just need people because there's going to be a lot of expensive equipment there for the band and the microphones and all that kind of stuff for the folks that will be preaching and teaching that weekend. Just need people who can kind of keep an eye on it through the night. And so if we have enough people sign up, we can take like 2-hour shifts or something like that. But these are just opportunities, and we have tables set up out in the atrium where you can sign up for this. Now, it's going to be a great event. It's coming up in June. The dates are there on your outline, and we really want this church to be involved in a big way in this event. Now, I want to introduce you to a member of the GNG family. His name's Jason Snyder, and Jason has been serving as our liaison with the Hope Over Heroin Project. Jason?
Good morning. For you, for those who don't know me, my family and I have been attending GNG for over 2 years now. I currently serve on a stage crew. My wife, Kelly, she sings with the worship band. And what I'd like to do now is introduce you to someone that's in recovery, that's part of our church family. And here's his story.
That's right, friends. It's me, Jason Snyder. And I want you to know and understand how I got to be an addict and what it's like to be in recovery. I want you to hear firsthand the struggles that come with addiction and let you see the hope and what we can accomplish together through Jesus Christ. I started drinking at around the age of 14. I grew up in a home where fighting, drinking, and using drugs were an everyday event. It wasn't all bad, but it was normal for me during my whole childhood experience. I was good at sports. I tried out for the Reds at age 16. I could have went on to play college ball as well, but my decisions were based on partying and having fun and not realizing I was heading for total chaos. I started using marijuana at age 16. I graduated and got a really good job. I was introduced to cocaine and I loved it. I turned into a huge dealer selling to big time people at my job. I got a dream car and then wrecked it. It progressed very quickly to pain meds, where I up the line to using anything and everything. I did meth for about 10 years and used heroin for the last 3 of the 10 years. I went multiple times to the court system. It all led up to several charges of being ordered to do FRS, counseling, multiple times, and rehab a couple of times. The last rehab was different for me, though. I was sick of life and how things were going. I wanted a change. I was to the point in my addiction where I didn't care if I lived or died. I started praying every day like they suggested and reading the Bible. I started going to meetings and I got involved with doing all sorts of service work. I began to realize that God had been protecting me throughout my whole life because my addiction could have killed me on several occasions. My wife Kelly was a high school love that I ruined several times. I know now that God had different plans. Just a few days after completing my last rehab program, we reconnected. Even after all the hurts and hang-ups, God brought us back together in His time. I made one of my first amends to Kelly, and I've taken her hostage for the last 5.5 years now. We got married, we have been baptized together, and are raising our kids the best way we know how in a Christian home. The first 2 or 3 years were rough for all of us in different ways, but we clung to God. He was our only hope in every situation that we faced. God has blessed us with 5 kids, and now a huge number of loving friends and family here at G&G. We are now active in our church and have been for over 2 years. I attend meetings and I work with other addicts almost every day. It is continuous work and some days are struggles. God has taken my desire to use away, but I still have dreams at times. I struggle with the consequences of my past actions daily. I know today that I am my own worst enemy and all I must do is get through the day being sober. Sometimes that's an extent of God's will for me today. Other days, which I try to make this a part of my life all the time, is being there for the next individual who is suffering from the same issues I have. I know if I'm in check spiritually, mentally, physically, that my wife and my kids reap benefits. I try to stay selfless, not selfish as I once was. These days, if it's getting to be all about Jason, my wife is quick to say, get to a meeting. I want the best for my wife and kids these days, 110%. I want to be the best possible person for my fellow recovery people and our community. I'm very thankful for God placing us in this church. I have a life group that I torture all the time who I feel loves me for the person I am. Today I can honestly say I love them and I strive to be a better person. So with the help from God's guidance, my loving wife and kids, this church, my 12-step meetings, the sponsor I have, and all the people who show me support, I've been clean since May 11, 2011. I have also been a practicing Christian who has dedicated my life to Christ since that time. For the past year or so, I've been on a committee called Hope for Highland County. We're trying to bring awareness to our issues and teach people how to help be a part of the solution. My sponsor has been telling me for 4 years now, if I'm not part of the solution, then I'm a part of the problem. So if you feel it in your heart and want to help in any way, get with me or anyone who is here from the committees and we can direct you in the right direction. I'll be out at the sign-up tables in the atrium, and I'd love to talk to you. God bless you, and thanks for being my church family.
Thank you. Friends, when you think about it, it's stories like Jason's that makes so much a part of what it is that we do. I mean, it reminds us that through Christ, lives can be saved, destinies can be changed, and families can be restored. And that's why we're here. We're here because people who were once in bondage to sin can be brought out of it, and then they can turn around and help other people. That's the deal for us. And that's why this church family cannot miss this opportunity to be involved in a problem that's facing our community. We can't ignore it. We can't pretend like it's just going to go away. It's there. And we need to face it head on because eternal destinies are at stake. We must act. As Christ laid down his life for you and me, it's time for us to give our lives in service to folks who are in need. Now, friends, years ago here at Good News Gathering, we discovered a poem that was written years and years ago by a British man by the name of C.T. Studd. He was a missionary who spent decades serving in China, India, and Africa. His poem has become a motto for this church because it captures perfectly the kind of church that God has called us to be. And his poem goes like this. He said, "Some want to live within the sound of church or chapel bell. I want to run a rescue shop within a yard of hell." You see, friends, God did not call Good News Gathering to become a monastery where a bunch of nice little Christians huddle up and stay inside to hide from the world. That's not what he called us to. God did not call this church to become a social club where we all get together and act nice and act like there are no problems. He called us to be a rescue shop. And he called this church to set up shop within a yard of hell. And friends, that's who we are. That's why we exist. And that's why I expect this family to be involved in this project in a huge way. Now, we're going to be out at the sign-up tables. And friends, this church needs to respond. I'll see you out there. Let's go to God in prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time that we could spend in your word and time that we could learn about this problem that is plaguing so many people in our community. Father, please help us as a church to be the friend of sinners. Because we all are. None of us is perfect. All of us need a Savior. And you have called us to share that saving grace with others. And so, Father, please help us to be the church that you called us to be, a rescue shop within a yard of hell. For this is our prayer in Christ's name. And we all agreed together and said, Amen.
We hope you enjoyed this lesson from Good News Gathering. For more information, visit www.goodnewsgathering.org or check us out on Facebook.